From the Moan Broadcast Center, this is Air Talk. Good morning, I'm Larry Mantle. The fatal Sacramento police shooting of Stephon Clark's led that department to limit foot pursuits. The intent is to reduce the risk of officers and suspects being injured. But with officers asked to make several spur-of-the-moment decisions, will the safer course of action be to let suspects get away? We'll debate the policy right after the news.
KBCC podcasts are supported by SoCal Gas, offering rebates for solar water heating. It works with a customer's existing natural gas water heater to offer reliable and efficient hot water. Invite the strength of the sun into your home or business. Info at SoCalGas.com/solar.
Good morning, it's Air Talk. I'm Larry Mantle. Great to have you with us. Hope your day's off to a good start. And hope we're coming through loud and clear, whether on the KPCC app, kpcc.org, or at 89.3. As you just heard in that story in Hetty's newscast, Cash Call and its lending practices going to be a subject we take up in the lead in our second hour of Air Talk, so please stay tuned for that. Coming up this hour, a new study finds the blue light from cell phones and tablets damage vision. Newer phones often offer blue light or night mode filters. Should we all use them? But first, the Sacramento Police Department has instituted a new foot pursuit policy. It follows the fatal police shooting of Stephon Clark last March. Police received a call of a man matching Clark's description breaking into parked cars. An airborne officer later reported the suspect attempting to break into a home sliding glass door. Officers pursued Clark on foot until confronting him in his grandparents' backyard. He was holding a cell phone, but no weapon. Clark was shot and killed. The new foot pursuit policy asks officers to consider their surroundings and the availability of backup. If pursuing, they must tell their supervisor why they're giving chase, give a description of the suspect, and activate their body cameras. But with officers asked to do all that within seconds, is it likely officers will just figure the safest thing is to let the suspect flee? With us is former police chief for Seattle. His career spans 34 years, and his latest book is To Protect and Serve, How to Fix America's Police, Norm Stamper. Thank you so much, sir, for being with us again on Air Talk.
Thank you for having me.
What do you think of the new policy that Sacramento, and they're not alone, that other departments are employing?
Well, I think it's a big step in the right direction. Many police departments, probably most, don't even have a policy on foot pursuits. And I think if we're going to help guide our officers, educate and train our officers, we have to start with a reasonable, defensible policy. So it's a good step in the right direction.
All right. And are you concerned that with officers asked to do all this assessment in the moment, provide the supervisor with information, that they may just figure, hey, it's just safer, let the person go?
Most of the cops I know, and I know many, are all about getting the job done well, getting it done safely. They understand that if they've observed or have been informed of the commission of a crime, particularly if it's a violent crime or somebody's at risk, that they have a job to do, and that is to do everything they possibly can to apprehend the person who's committed that crime. But I want to say this right from the get-go, and that is that there are too many police officers who I think have allowed police work to become a competitive activity. I don't know if it's being brought up on video games or just exactly what it is, but you've got a bad guy and you've got a cop, and the cop's job is to chase them down no matter what, apprehend them. And I think it's important that we stop and ask ourselves whether or not we're doing an adequate job in persuading officers that the preservation and protection of human life is their number one priority. They are here to save lives, not take lives. Now, given that as a backdrop, I think it's also important to recognize it's a damn difficult job. I mean, it really is. And decisions are oftentimes made in split seconds. But the more training, education, the more maturity and confidence that our officers have, the more likelihood that I heard an officer say this a couple of months ago. When I go out every night on my shift, it's with this motto in mind: nobody dies tonight.
Norm, when you were a beat cop in San Diego, did you have many foot pursuits you were involved with?
I got chewed out royally as a rookie police officer for bailing out of a car. My senior officer was behind the wheel and chasing a suspect. We didn't even really know what he was wanted for. There had been a call earlier, shades of Sacramento, of car prowls. But we weren't certain of that, but we saw a guy run, and I jumped out of the car and started chasing him. And my senior officer, to his everlasting credit, just lit into me when we got reunited. He said, "Don't you ever do that again. We communicate. We are partners. If a chase is necessary, we're gonna at least allow ourselves a moment of thought to how best and most effectively and most safely to carry out that chase." So I was reckless, and I got scolded for it. I got evaluated badly as a result of it. I'll never forget it.
We're talking with Norm Stamper, former chief of police for Seattle. He was with the San Diego department as a beat officer starting his career. I'd love to hear your thoughts, particularly if you are in law enforcement. What do you think of Sacramento's policy, other departments as well, implementing new policies around foot pursuits? We're at 866-893-KPECC. Do you think having these limits and these requirements or guidelines for foot pursuits are a positive, that they benefit public safety and officer safety, or do you think they're a detriment? 866-893-KPECC or the Air Talk page, kpecc.org. Also with us, he teaches police studies at John Jay College of Criminal Justice at City University, New York, Joseph Jackalone, a retired sergeant who spent two decades with NYPD. Mr. Jackalone, thank you for being with us.
Yes, thanks for having me.
What do you think of these new policies?
Well, most of them, look at them, you know, at the face of it, it's kind of common sense. I mean, if you're going to chase somebody, at least be able to give out your location, what you believe they're wanted for, and, you know, a direction of flight and a description. I mean, some of that's just basic police work. I don't see that much of a big deal with that. Yeah, the only thing I take issue with is notifying the supervisor and, you know, telling him or her what's going on. Listen, it's the supervisor's job to be monitoring the radio, right? So if they hear a pursuit come over, they should already automatically be headed to the scene. You know, it shouldn't be up to the cop to be giving directions to the sergeant or a lieutenant at that point. And you know what? You do run the risk. I mean, with all these new rules and regulations about what you can and cannot do and don't do this, don't do that, I mean, there's going to be a number of cops who are just going to say, I'm not going to do anything. And they're going to go into their blue cocoon, and they're going to sit in their radio car, and they're going to become report takers again. The age of proactive policing are over for many cops. And I think that, you know, they feel that as if I'm going to get involved and something goes sideways, the chief is going to need shoulder surgery from throwing me under the bus so many times.
Now, is this a result of coming up with guidelines like this that you think officers just feel like, hey, I'm going to just be judged too strictly if I decide a pursuit and, you know, that second guessed? Or is it the matter of notifying the supervisor, that the time that's involved? What do you think has that chilling effect in this instance?
Well, it's the second-guessing part. I mean, everybody is a police expert nowadays. You know, just go to social media, and they'll tell you how the job should have been handled. But policing and even the chief just said over there before that, you know, it's things happen in a split second. And to be able to process all that and be able to get on the radio and notify this person and do this and do that, I think is asking for an awful lot from that officer who could be, you know, and you got to remember, it could be a scary situation going on where the guy is armed and he's chasing him. And the last thing I want as an officer to concentrate on what I have to tell the supervisors and what's going on than to, you know, take up a tactical position to be able to, you know, be mindful of heading around, you know, corners and the like, because we've had instances where cops have been killed, you know, going around the corner and they were chasing somebody. So it's, you know, I think I can understand why they're doing it, but it can't be because you had this shooting that seem to go sideways. You just can't come up with rules based on, you know, one particular instance when you think of the thousands of interactions that police officers make every day without any issue.
Well, I was reading a story in the Sacramento Bee about the new policy, and one of the law enforcement experts quoted said, actually, in this case, the shooting of Stephon Clark, it really wouldn't have led to any change because this would have still been considered a justified foot pursuit because of the helicopter officer seeing the suspect attempting to break into the sliding door. That would be perceived as such a threat to life that they wouldn't have just let him go. So their argument is even in this case that according to the Sacramento department, has led to the new policy, it wouldn't have affected this fatal shooting.
Well, sure. And the other issue is that, you know, we're not talking about vehicle pursuits, which is a whole other issue. Right? We're talking about a foot pursuit, where the only danger to the point at this point is to the officer themselves because they're out in the open. So this is just something that, some cops are going to look at as just another thing that politicians are throwing upon them. And, you know, with the permission of the police chiefs, who by many cops are viewed as just extensions of the politician that's in charge.
We're talking with Joseph Jackalone, who teaches police studies at John Jay College of Criminal Justice in New York, retired sergeant, 20 years with NYPD. Also with us, the former chief of police for Boca Raton, Florida, Andrew J. Scott. He's the president of AJS Consulting. He's an expert witness on police practices and procedures. Mr. Scott, thank you for being with us.
It's my pleasure. Thank you.
So what do you think of the trend Sacramento and some other departments coming up with these more narrow guidelines for police foot pursuit?
Well, let me echo both the chief and the sergeant with regards to their comments. The policy is not that restrictive. They're just memorializing it in a more fashioned manner. And the bottom line is all of the data and information that an officer needs to give to the dispatcher, the description, the reason for pursuing, so on and so forth, are all given to dispatch right off the bat. I do not know of a police officer engaged in a foot pursuit that would not have provided that information. That dispatcher then gets it to the supervisor, which he or she will make a decision whether to continue on the pursuit or not. The second thing is that pursuits are not well memorialized in policies of law enforcement agencies throughout the country. That being said, there is such a tremendous repository of information from the International Association of Chiefs of Police, of which they created a model policy on foot pursuits. And in that model policy, it cautions officers to engage, when you engage in a foot pursuit, it is a dangerous, more dangerous occupational hazard because you are exponentially increasing your threat of your safety because you're engaging in a foot pursuit. You don't know the area as well as perhaps the subject knows, and of course, there's always the blind corners. Now, in Miami, we reduced and restricted foot pursuits because two police officers back in the 90s were shot and killed and ambushed as a result of foot pursuits. So I'm familiar with the restrictive nature of it, but I don't believe the Sacramento Police Department's policy is so onerous that it's going to cause police officers not to engage in a pursuit. I would recommend complete caution for an officer to engage in a foot pursuit unless it's a life or death situation. Going back to the shooting incident involving the Sacramento Police Department, in that particular incident, the expert is absolutely correct that policy, if that foot pursuit policy was in place, that shooting would not have been avoided because there was a totally different circumstances, so on and so forth. So that would not have prevented the shooting. So to connect the foot pursuit policy with the shooting in a means to mitigate something like that, I'm not quite sure if that's the correlation. I do encourage, though, that foot pursuit policies do provide some protection for the officer and gives that officer the discretion to engage in a foot pursuit knowing the cautions. So having said all of that, I think it's a prudent thing that the police department engaged in creating a new policy. I don't find it that onerous. And I'd hate to think, as the sergeant suggested, the blue cocoon where officers aren't going to get involved in doing their job. It's also referred to as the Ferguson effect. But I'd hate to see that because the only people that suffer is the general public.
We're talking with the former police chief of Boca Raton, Florida, Andrew J. Scott, who currently has a consultancy on police practices and procedures. Gwen writes on the Air Talk page, I live in Boyle Heights, have an apartment with a great view of surrounding streets and balcony. One night I saw a police chase, and the car being chased crashed into another on my corner. The suspect darted out of his car. The police got out on foot, chased him down my street. The suspect tried to climb our fence, and the police caught up to him and arrested him. When it's your street, you definitely want the police to catch them, not just let them climb into your front yard and run through. You can share your comment on the Air Talk page, kpecc.org. I want to thank our guests, Andrew J. Scott, Joseph Jackalone, and Norm Stamper, for sharing their thoughts about Sacramento and other police departments' moves to come up with narrower guidelines for when officer pursuits on foot are acceptable. Coming up on Air Talk, a new study that looks at the health implications of blue light from phone and tablet screens. Might it end up permanently damaging one's eyes? We'll talk about that in just 1 minute. Great to have you with us this morning on Air Talk. I'm Larry Mantle. Over the past few years, a number of studies have raised concerns about blue light, that part of the spectrum that is said to have an effect on a variety of different processes in the body. Now a new study that's out from the University of Toledo and published in Scientific Reports says that blue light can actually do permanent damage to one's eyes. With us to talk about his study, Assistant Professor of Chemistry and Biochemistry at the University of Toledo, Ajit Karunaratne. Thank you very much, Professor, for being with us.
Thank you for having me.
Share with us how you conducted the study and determined the damage that blue light presents to eyes.
So what we were looking at is my lab studied the photoreceptor signaling, you know, the photoreceptors that allow us to see blue, red, and green colors, so help us to generate chromatic vision. So in one of our control experiments, without any photoreceptors, we just simply use this molecule that act as a light harvesting antenna for these photoreceptors. The name of this molecule is retinal. It's a small aldehyde, a product derived from vitamin A. So when we have this molecule with cells, really nothing happens. But when you expose these cells to blue light, we observe cells are dying and also a lot of cellular changes indicating cytotoxicity, I mean toxic effect on cells. So we tested multiple different colors, UV, blue, yellow, green, and red. Both UV and blue light was able to induce this cytotoxic effect. When you don't have this molecule coming from the eye, which is retinal, blue light cannot do much. So this is actually the beginning of this study that kind of, you know, we start seeing that, yes, I mean, blue light is definitely inducing cytotoxicity, and there is a molecular mechanism that is underlying that toxicity.
Well, so what's the theory of that molecule, and why blue light specifically does this damage?
So this molecule, this light harvesting antenna, when it binds to photoreceptors, it can absorb blue light, green light, and red light. So that's how we see the colors. Once photoreceptors use this molecule, they release them. And this release molecule can absorb light energy, I mean, the wavelength around 400 nanometers, which is the blue light. So the specific ability of this molecule to absorb right in the blue region is very crucial in this investigation. The second aspect to that is our eyes reflect UV light. So UV light doesn't get into eye for the most part. However, human eye is transparent to blue light. So if blue light enter the eye, it just goes into the retina, focused by the lens. So now you have a molecule in the eye that can absorb blue light, and blue light has no resistance to get in. So that's how we kind of link the study.
How can you take this to the next step to determine that this reaction is actually taking place in the human eye? Because you've got, I assume, some ethical barriers to doing this with humans. Is that true?
That is very true. The next step of this investigation steps are actually extremely sophisticated because, you know, when we go out to sunlight, we really don't look at sun, and that can cause, blindness. We just see the reflected and diffuse light. But when you look at a blue light source, we have a lens in the eye which focuses this scattered light into one spot in the retina. So now the challenge is how to measure what is the intensity of these light spots that is, focused by the lens in the retina, and then see if such intensity is in cellular conditions can induce the cell death and toxicity. So we are working on those aspects right now. So we first try to go into more, you can obtain cow retina and then conduct some of the studies. So those are some of the current works going on in the lab.
We're talking with University of Toledo Assistant Professor Ajit Karunaratne, who is co-author of a study published in Scientific Reports, which shows damage to cells in the eye from blue light. Again, there's more study that needs to be done to determine that this actually is fully replicable in the human eye, but the indications of this study cause for concern about blue light damage. Now, Professor, my phone, I have an Android phone that has a built-in blue light filter, which I'm able to activate. The screen turns more of a yellowish color instead of a brighter, what appears white or blue light. Do you have any sense of how much of the blue light those different filters filter, and are they able to mitigate much of the damage?
So in these devices, I'm not a technical expert, but based on my general understanding, so they are RGB, so red, blue, and green. So simply these devices, I guess when you turn the blue filter on, they just turn off the blue channel, and so that will stop blue light emission. So that can have implication to the color of your images that you look at. I mean, that's why you're seeing it's becoming more yellowish, because it doesn't have that blue component to generate the correct, image tones. So I'm my personal opinion is those filters can definitely help if such the damage can occur by turning those filters on.
What do you do personally? Do you have a blue light filter that you use all the time, or just when the room is dark, when you're looking at a screen? How do you deal with it?
Right. So, after this investigation, before that, I'm completely unaware of these events. Didn't pay much attention to it. So after this investigation, what I do is I do not look at the computer or blue light screens in the dark. The reason behind it is that when we are in dark, our pupils are dilated and cell can take a lot of light. So most light coming from the screens and devices can enter that may reach the damaging levels. So, but when you have some ambient light in the room, so that will help your pupils to contract a little bit and then reduce the amount of light entering, which may bring down the light intensity level below the threshold.
So you don't necessarily use the blue light filter during the regular day when there's ambient light?
I don't.
All right. We're talking with University of Toledo Professor of Chemistry and Biochemistry Ajit Karunaratne. Also with us, Jeremy Kaplan, Editor-in-Chief of the online publication Digital Trends. Thank you very much, Jeremy, for joining us.
It's always a pleasure. Thanks for having me.
So how have smartphone manufacturers responded to this? I mentioned my phone has a blue light filter. How common are these in smartphones today?
You hit the nail right in the head. The blue light filter has become a fairly common device on most manufacturers, and it goes by a variety of different names. So on an iPhone, it's called Night Shift. The majority of Samsung Galaxy phones have a blue light filter. They just call it blue light filter. It's Night Light on Google Pixel. It's Comfort View. But whatever it is, it's designed to mitigate a different factor, which is caused by the blue light, which is that blue light tends to keep you up. Looking at a blue light screen late at night is going to keep you awake. So that's why we're calling it a night shift. They shifted to a yellow light, which is more likely or more conducive to sleep, I should say. That said, it sounds like that might have an added health benefit. I think there's been a lot of study surrounding the health impact of blue light. I don't know if we've necessarily quantified it as harmful just yet, although the study goes a long way towards getting there.
Go ahead. I'm sorry.
Work to do still on this issue.
And Jeremy, for those who might have older phones which don't have these blue light modes or night mode, are there third-party apps that are able to change the hardware display?
Yeah, there's a blue light filter you can download for any Android phone called Twilight. And if you have an older iPhone, I believe they introduced the night light mode in iOS 9, so you should still be able to get that on most current iPhones.
And do you know if manufacturers have or are looking at a potential consumer warning about blue light exposure, or are they just waiting to see, to your knowledge, more studies come in on it?
Well, that's a good question. There are a lot of health questions currently surrounding cell phones. I'm sure you've talked about the radiation issue on your program before as well, which has been an ongoing concern for well more than a decade. I don't see this being an issue that's going to get resolved conclusively anytime soon. And let's be honest, consumer electronics manufacturers aren't going to discourage you from buying their devices. So I think that they feel like they've gone far enough to mitigate this issue with these types of solutions. And to the professor's point, the fact that the retina allows more light in during the day should mitigate the harmful impact of blue light during the day. So it sounds like the solution that we have in place is actually a good one on a couple of different levels and might go a ways toward preventing potential health problems.
Jeremy Kaplan of Digital Trends, he's editor-in-chief of the publication, joining us on Air Talk. If you have questions for our guests, we're at 866-893-KPECC, 866-893-5722. Professor Karun Natrani can talk about his study specifically. Jeremy Kaplan can talk about the tech side of this, how the companies are responding to these concerns. 866-893-KPECC or the Air Talk page, kpecc.org. Professor, would this apply to essentially any display at all? Because presumably all of them give off blue light.
I don't believe so. I think when you look at those old LCD screens, fairly, you know, yellowish color with the I don't exactly know the name of TFT, something like that. Maybe Jeremy can help me there. Those are black and white screens. I don't think they can cause, they can emit a substantial amount of blue light. But I think...
I guess I was thinking of the newer generation, laptop displays, tablets, and the like.
Right. So any device that can generate color, so to generate the color, you need those three basic colors. So the device required to generate blue light.
And Jeremy, I wonder, would it be possible in some way to mimic the effect of blue light without really using blue light? To your knowledge, of manufacturers looked, or is that just inherently impossible?
No, I think you need to have blue light in order to get images to look the way that we want them to. To your point about the different types of displays, one of the real thorny issues that a study like this raises is that in our lives we are surrounded by displays, and all of them do emit this type of blue light: television screens, laptop screens, tablets and phones, etc. Which is why you mentioned the response from the electronics manufacturing industry. There has been a big movement lately towards overall wellness, which is being seen in things like Samsung's new Galaxy Watch, which is focused heavily on overall wellness. You see that in the new iPhone, which has a screen time function designed to limit the amount of time, or I should say help you to limit the amount of time that you spend on your phones. And there are things that push even further than that. A company called Republic Wireless makes a device called the Relay, which is essentially a cell phone replacement for children. It's basically a walkie-talkie, but it's a cell phone without a screen, in a sense. It's the anti-cell phone. And there's a company called Light. You can find info on them on thelightphone.com or at Digital Trends. And they make a similar product that is designed to be a very, very limited phone.
All right.
To help you get back to being a human being and not a cell phone addict.
Jeremy, you've perfectly set the table for our next segment, which is about school policies for the use of smartphones. You're talking about limits on kids using their devices. We're going to take that up when we continue. But let me thank you, Jeremy Kaplan, editor-in-chief of Digital Trends. My thanks to Professor Karuna Ratney of the University of Toledo. As we come back, as I mentioned, with students going back to school in many districts today, we'll talk about how schools are attempting to adapt with the usage of smartphones. It's Air Talk on 89.3 KPCC, back right after a live update from Hedy Lynn Hurdies. Great to have you with us on Air Talk. I'm Larry Mantle. Students returning to classrooms today throughout the LA Unified School District. Many other districts started this week as well. Some go back starting next week. It gives us an opportunity to look at smartphone policies on campus. Now, France has just enacted a ban on students up to age 15 using a smartphone anywhere on school grounds. They're required to leave their phones at home. Most districts in Southern California have more liberal policies than that, but even between districts, they differ a fair amount. Some of the districts allow students to use their cell phones in between classes. Others have a ban throughout the school day. Some allow students to use their phones on campus before and after classes are done. And some allow the phones to be used in class with the permission of the teacher. My question for you as a parent or student or educator, what do you think is the most effective policy for smartphone use on campus or not? 866-893-KPECC, 866-893-5722, or the Air Talk page, kpecc.org. With me from the University of Michigan, Clinical Associate Professor of Education Tech, Liz Kolb. Professor, thank you for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
I was fascinated just seeing in Southern California how different the policies are district to district. Do you see any sort of evolving trend in smartphone use on campus?
Absolutely. We definitely have different policies district to district, but the trend over the last decade has been to be more inclusive with cell phones, since there is kind of a tidal wave of cell phones coming into schools. Schools have found that completely banning them and keeping them off campus has not been very effective. So they've kind of loosened the reins on that, and we're starting to see schools trying to figure out whether or not they want to use them for instructional use, and if they don't, how to manage them when they're in the school building.
Now, many districts, I don't know whether this is pro forma now, have an acceptable use agreement for digital technology, and students are expected to sign that, parents as well. Are districts looking at just applying that to the personal smartphone?
Absolutely. Some schools do have the smartphone and cell phones included in their acceptable use or responsible use policies. And other districts are actually leaving it up to the individual school within the district. So high schools sometimes have more lenient policies, whereas an elementary school or middle schools have more strict policies.
All right. Also with us is a lecturer in education and director of secondary teacher education at Bates College in Maine, Anita Charles. Thank you very much, Ms. Charles, for being with us.
Thank you.
Now, you've been there in the trenches in the classroom. What do you think is the best policy for a district or for a school to employ?
I have been there in the trenches, and I've also been there as a parent, watching my own children grapple with these same issues, and myself as a parent. And I think that some of the policies that I see are happening in some of the areas around you are reasonable ones. For example, they're to be used for instructional purposes. The key thing is that we don't want cell phones to interrupt with learning or safety of students. But I think, as Liz was saying, an all-out ban is seldom effective. It's unenforceable, and it begs for subversion. It also tends to show a lack of trust in the relational aspect between students and parents. Students and teachers. And it tends to show a lack of foresight as well, because there will be all sorts of new and different technology coming around the corner that we are going to have trouble staying ahead of if we do all-out bans.
Let's talk with Vanessa, who joins us from the San Bernardino County community of Highland. Hi, Vanessa.
Hi, how are you? I just wanted to say that as a former high school teacher, now stay-home mom, in my classroom, when they walked in the door, I took every cell phone from my student and put it in the in a bowl in the front of my desk, and there was just no need for them to have it. Worst case scenario, if a parent needs to contact them, of course they can call the school. There's no need for them to have a cell phone during my class period.
You think it's okay, though, for the student to have a phone on his or her person before and after school if the parents need to coordinate pickup or that sort of thing?
You know, as a mom, I know where my kid is at all times, and I guess having a cell phone could be helpful in the morning or after school, but I just think from as soon as the bell rings until the bell closes that day, there's no need for a parent to not know where their child is. They should be at the school. They can contact them at the school. And I think the parent's thinking is, oh, I need to be able to contact my student. Well, you can always call the main office, and this administration would never allow a student not to talk to their parent during the day.
Vanessa, I appreciate your call. Thanks so much. As a former high school teacher, sharing your thoughts on this. Anita Charles, what do you think?
Yeah, I appreciate Vanessa's point as from a teacher's perspective. I think that different teachers set up different policies, including things like having a box where everybody puts their phone. That relies on a certain degree of trust that students are going to do that. And I think that that is a reasonable policy to have in the classroom. But part of my issue as a teacher is that phones today are now so much more than a phone. For example, somebody might want to take a picture of a homework assignment on the board or put something into their calendar, or maybe listen to music during a downtime for blocking out distractions. It might be used as a dictionary or other resources. So I think that even that kind of a policy, depending on what a teacher is doing in the classroom, also banning a cell phone in the classroom itself doesn't necessarily keep kids off of other kinds of devices. So, for example, watches that kids are wearing now that have some of the same capacity. So I think it is, I think what Vanessa's point partly is that it's, you know, contextual based on that teacher's expectations in the classroom, and that feels intuitively right to me that teachers need to have some control over that.
All right, let me share some more comments. Tara writes on the page, I need my kids to have their phones before and after school, since we often need to coordinate pickups or change of plans, and there are no viable alternatives. I do wish they wouldn't have the phone on them at all during school hours. I think the best answer would be phone lockers just for devices, and they must be in there from the first to the last bell of school. That's Tara's suggestion. Liz Kolb, what do you think?
Yeah, I actually think that Tara and Vanessa both are speaking to a larger issue, which is that I'm noticing that schools and parents are not having conversations about this. They're just kind of pointing fingers back and forth. I am a parent of a rising sixth grader, and I went to the middle school orientation, and the message from the principal was, we know kids are going to have cell phones, here's the banning policy. And there was no information about education for parents, a readiness checklist for using cell phones, or research around mental health issues in cell phones, or impulse control issues and such. So there's a lot of information that parents don't have from schools, including the first caller who was worried about, who didn't want the phones in her classroom because they were distracting. A lot of parents aren't aware of this, and they're not familiar with how distracting their children's devices can be. And a lot of schools, instead of educating the parents and also preparing their teachers to have devices, they're just creating banning policies. And I think it would be very beneficial for schools to not just create banning policies, but also to educate their teachers on ways they can use it for instruction, and also to educate their teachers to talk to the students about mental health issues and screen time and self-regulation that comes with cell phone use. And a lot of teachers just don't feel comfortable and prepared to do that, which is why often they're very frustrated with the cell phone.
We're talking with University of Michigan Tech in the Classroom expert Liz Kolb, also Anita Charles with us from Bates College in Maine, and we're taking your calls. Great to see teachers and former teachers weighing in on this. Also love hearing from more parents what you think the best smartphone policy should be for schools in the classroom. 866-893-KPCC. Back in one single minute. Any education topic that we take on Air Talk, it's wonderful to have so many professional educators in the audience to weigh in with their perspectives. Such pleasure, and appreciate hearing from you now as we talk about smartphones on campus or in the classroom. 866-893-KPECC or the Air Talk page, kpecc.org. With us is Drew in the city of Orange. Drew, I understand you're a high school teacher?
Yeah, I teach at an art school, and at our welcome back, we had a whole meeting about this, and it was really productive. So what the school did is they bought cubbies in each classroom for each student, a number associated with each student. So it wasn't like a trust issue of like, oh, I hope you put your cell phone away. It's, you know, you're number three, you're here, your cell phone is in your cubby, and it's a clear plastic sleeve for everybody. And then they bought Google Chromebooks for everybody. So you can't use the excuse of, oh, I need my phone to look something up or something, because you have internet access on a tablet with the tablet assigned to every student. So then if they want to use their phone to take a picture of an assignment or listen to music, they have to come up, get it, and it's all very clear, and the whole policy was very, very streamlined.
Very good. Anita Charles, what do you think of that?
That sounds great. It sounds to me like they're trying to get on top of allowing students to have access to the kinds of tools, devices, applications, and so on that are really helpful to have, while at the same time trying to get a handle on some of the more subversive uses of cell phones. So that sounds pretty reasonable to me. I think I want to go back briefly to what Liz said about we tend to miss the boat if we're only about the policies. We have to also have the conversations. We have to talk to students about why and how and what are we trying to help them do when we put it in that cubby, or what are we hoping they will learn to understand about appropriate contexts and that kind of thing. So I think we're missing a lot of that conversation in schools generally, and probably at homes as well, because we as adults are also just trying to figure out what's going on.
Yeah. Parents are often, you know, caught flat-footed on this. Tracy in Torrance, I understand you're a middle school teacher.
Yes, I am, in Torrance, California, Jefferson Middle School.
Very good. Outstanding school district. So what do you think about this, and what policy do you or your school employ?
Well, we have computer carts, and almost every classroom has a cart, but I don't. And when I do use technology, if I can't get a computer cart, well, they say, can we use our phones? I said, sure. You know, but I think the idea about regulating and setting it up in the beginning of the year, this is our policy, this is because, you know, I think that's really important what your previous commentator said. But I see it all the time, and I have to regulate, because when it goes off in my classroom, they go to the office. Because it's interrupting me.
Yeah, absolutely. And if you're in the middle of a critical point with your students, last thing you want is the distraction. Everybody turns to the phone. Tracy, so you see the kids using the phone in the classroom if there isn't a computer. This sort of this makes up for that?
Oh, absolutely. Videos. Why should I record them? They record themselves and they send it to me. Oh, absolutely. Because I don't have the technology, so they're going to use it. And then the ones who don't have phones, which there are a few who don't, they group up with someone who does. But as far as, you know, using it appropriately, that has to be set up. And that's in the beginning of the year, that conversation.
So you tell them, look, if your phone goes off, you're headed out of the room. So they know that going in.
Chow. Usually it's at the end of the period, because I don't want them to leave my class.
All right, Tracy, appreciate it very much. Professor Kolb, what do you think?
Absolutely. I think Tracy has some excellent points. One of the big points is at the very beginning of the year in teaching, we set up kind of norms and routines, and part of that procedure and process should be setting up norms, routines, and a social contract around digital citizenship and technology use. And you would be surprised at how well when you're giving the students a little bit of responsibility and autonomy over making these decisions, that they make good decisions around the classroom norms that they set up. And sometimes they're even a little bit more strict or stringent than maybe you would be. But again, it's having that conversation that Anita was referring to of the why. Like, why would we want to not always use our cell phones? Well, we can't multitask, so we have to be able to self-regulate. And it sounds as though your caller is really trying to do that. And the second thing that she hit on, which is really important, is that in with some of our lower-income students, sometimes their only technology, digital access comes from a cell phone from home, and sometimes it's not even theirs, maybe their parents. They might not have a traditional laptop or desktop with Wi-Fi access. So in order to try to be more accessible and equitable, it is important to model how to use cell phones for instructional use, academic use, and for professional growth.
So many great comments here. Don't have time for all of them, but I do want to bring up Nancy in Brentwood said, children of any age cannot learn with a phone in hand. I would love if the guest could speak about the consequences of social media on children, depression, anxiety. I mean, Anita Charles, that's the potential harm here, right? If kids are accessing their phones during the school day, it could be used in a way that's emotionally harmful.
It absolutely could be. I think that that's a fair concern to have in today's world. We live in a very anxious time, and we have access to so much at the touch of a button and in front of our eyes. And that is, again, one of the reasons that we want to make sure that we're talking to students about that. How are you feeling when you're on there? What happens to, you know, maybe teaching them a little bit about how the brain works, about how our bodies are working. We do this with so many other aspects of a teenager's life. It's true that a teenager may not learn with that phone in their hands per se if they're on a lot of this social media. On the other hand, they also are not going to learn how to manage it if it's not, if we don't allow them some access. It's kind of like how we learn to drive a car or how we learn about any of the issues mm-hmm. in our lives. So teenagers have lives that are based in risk, and we do need to learn how to balance the risk with the benefits.
Let me share some more comments. Evelyn in Reseda says, I'm a parent of a high school student. When the school goes on lockdown, I want to know where my child is and that she's safe. It's important for students to have phones available for safety. Alicia in Echo Park says, I was a teacher at an international private boarding school, and I have a split opinion. In some ways, very helpful for using their phones for translations and lectures. They use their phones to keep up in other ways, but in other ways, it was a distraction. Paul in Glendora says, I'm a former teacher. Phones could be used effectively for reading articles and research. There should not be one policy for all schools. It really depends on the composition of the kids. Some want to stay on their phone all the time. Others can use it wisely. You can share your comments on the Air Talk page, kpcc.org. And my thanks to our guests, Liz Kolb and Anita Charles.
KPCC podcasts are supported by SoCal Gas, helping businesses improve their bottom line with solar water heating. The system preheats your water using the strength of the sun. It works with your existing natural gas water heater to warm your water in a reliable and efficient way. You may save on your SoCal Gas bill and get rebates that may cover up to 80% of the system's cost. With these rebates, heating water with the sun could be a sound investment. It's the strength of the sun in your business. Learn more at SoCalGas.com/solar.
Good morning. It's Air Talk. I'm Larry Mantle. Wonderful to have you with us today. Hope things are going well for you. It's always an honor to have you in the audience listening to the program. Coming up later this hour, we're going to open up the phones. I want to hear from women who work in medicine and law, because as the majority now of graduates of medical schools and law schools are women, my assumption is that we're seeing some pretty dramatic changes in those professions when it comes to gender. And I'd like to hear from women what your perception is as to how women are treated in the environment of your profession. That's coming up later this hour. Looking forward to all the great calls I know that we're going to get. But first, we turn our attention to a California Supreme Court ruling that was released yesterday. And the case involves Orange County-based Cash Call and about the interest rates that they charged for a number of their loans. Now, for loans of a particular dollar threshold, the state legislature has not put a cap on what those interest rates are, but quizzically they included in their legislation about loans that the rates could not be unconscionable. So, you know, one person's unconscionable may not be another's. Though that's what led this ambiguity to take the case all the way to the California Supreme Court, which determined that Cash Call's loan rates were unconscionable. But notably, the high court didn't say what the threshold of unconscionable is. With us to talk about the significance of the case for short-term lenders is James Sturdivant, who's a consumer rights and class action attorney. He represents the borrowers in the case De La Torre versus Cash Call. Mr. Sturdivant, thank you for being with us.
Good to be with you this morning.
Share with us what you think unconscionable is. I mean, is there some threshold here that a court could find that would provide clarity?
Well, it's a flexible concept. It has been a flexible concept for centuries and has been a flexible concept since it was applied to price terms by the California Supreme Court 37 years ago in Purdue versus Crocker National Bank, which is cited throughout the opinion. It means terms that, taken under the totality of circumstances at the time the contracts are entered into, make the terms overly harsh to one of the parties to the agreement.
Right.
We believe that the interest rate in isolation, but particularly in combination with the other terms of these loans, that they be repaid at interest rates from 96 to 135% over a period of 3.5 years renders them unconscionable or overly harsh.
And were these loans that were originally designed as short-term loans, that's why the interest rate was so high, but the borrower was not able to afford to repay?
No, during the class period from 2004 through July of 2011, the terms remained the same. They were always payable over 3.5 years.
At these interest rates?
From 96% to 135%.
Now, I assume the only reason someone would take a loan out at that interest rate is that they were not able to collateralize the loan. Is that right?
The borrowers in this case were very low-income individuals with very bad FICO scores. They had no other place to go. They couldn't get a regular loan. So now these loans in 2016, 2017 are being offered by lenders, including Cash Call, at more than 210%. And some of the terms are more than 3.5 years. Some of the terms are 4 years.
And what do you think would be a conscionable rate for these uncollateralized loans to be offered at?
Well, that's for the judge to determine when we get to trial next year. But I will tell you this. It doesn't take a rocket scientist sitting in a chair to determine that rates of 96%, 135%, 210%, even independent of the 3.5 year repayment term, is unconscionable.
And what's the default rate on these loans in the class?
Yeah, the other facts of the case, which we developed in evidence, which we submitted to the federal trial court in 2014, were that Cash Call developed this $2,600 loan product based on a known default rate of 40 to 45%, and that those loans to Cash Call were still profitable at that rate. It singled out and did extensive marketing to very low-income Californians. It implemented policies of very extreme debt collection practices. Then it charged off loans in default, which were purchased by entities called debt buyers, which then filed debt collection actions against the borrower, threatened them to even make their credit reports worse, to garnish their wages, to levy any bank account they could find.
I guess what I'm trying to get at is, with a default rate of 40 to 45%, it would seem, and no collateral, it would seem that the lender would have to have way over market rate interest to be able to offer that product. So does anybody have a figure that they think would allow companies like Cash Call to feel it's financially viable to offer the product for people who otherwise couldn't borrow money, but that wouldn't fit the legal definition of unconscionable?
Larry, this isn't any different than the mortgage foreclosure crisis when we went through the Great Recession earlier this century. Loans are being made to people who Cash Call and other predatory lenders know can't afford the loan from the outset. But they make those loans because in the aggregate, they make significant profit from the portfolio of borrowers. But in some of these cases, people shouldn't have got the homes that they were encouraged to buy in the early years of this century. And some of the borrowers from Cash Call shouldn't have gotten these loans.
We're talking with James Sturtevant. He represents the borrowers in this class action case, De La Torre versus Cash Call. Yesterday, the California Supreme Court releasing its decision that Cash Call engaged in unconscionable loan terms and interest rates. Also with us, senior attorney and partner at Hudson Cook Law Firm, which represents consumer lenders but did not represent Cash Call. In this case, Alan Denson. Sir, thank you for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
So what's the challenge going to be for the lower courts now to determine what does not violate lending laws?
Well, I think really what the challenge is going to be is finding what types of cases there is necessarily going to be unconscionability. The court in this case really just said that unconscionability is a theory that the plaintiffs could prevail on in this case. They really haven't drawn a line that there are any specific loans here that are unconscionable and have not said that any specific interest rates are unconscionable. Really, what they've said is that it's a very fact-specific inquiry, and you've got to look at both the bargaining process for how a consumer chooses to enter into that loan. And then you have to look at the actual interest rate term at the same time. And so I don't think they really drew any bright lines. And those lines are going to have to be drawn in either this specific case or in future cases to come.
And is that going to come from the courts? Or is the court going to be willing to say, well, under these terms, unconscionable, under these terms, not, because loan products can vary in a number of different ways? Is that still going to leave gray area? And might the legislature have an appetite for coming in and setting actual terms of legal caps on loans?
It could be that the legislature will eventually revisit that issue of caps on loans of this amount or higher, but right now there's just a substantial gray area, and the courts will have to determine in each specific circumstance whether there's unconscionability, and they'll have to look at default rates. They'll have to look at whether the product is economically viable or not at these allegedly high interest rates. And they will have to look at how does the bargain occur? Is there a cooling off period after application? Is there a right to rescind within 24 hours? Many lenders who provide this type of product do include those, and in courts you're going to have to look at all of those specific circumstances.
Richard in Simi Valley called. He says he's a bankruptcy attorney, and he's had a lot of clients contact him as a result of short-term loans. He says lenders don't make money on the loan itself. They make the money when the loan defaults. The borrower gets trapped, and they collect their money with the high interest rates over time. Alan Denson, quick response to that contention.
I think most lenders, and certainly the ones that we work with, want their loans to perform, and their customers are happier. They're more likely to recommend their product when they don't enter a collection cycle and that the loans are performing.
All right. I want to thank you both, Alan Denson of Hudson Cook Law, James Sturtevant of the Sturtevant Law Firm, represents the borrowers in the Della Torre versus Cash Call case. You can share your comments on the AirTalk page, kpecc.org. In just a minute, we're going to take a look at how fire insurance, homeowners insurance, might change as a result of all the wildfires that have damaged and destroyed so many structures throughout the Golden State. It's Air Talk on KPCC. Over the past couple of years, thousands of structures have been destroyed here in California. And with all the payouts that's necessitated by homeowners insurers, the question is, what effect is this going to have on rates or even on the availability of insurance? Will more regions of the state be designated extremely high risk? With us is KPCC infrastructure correspondent Sharon McNary. Sharon, good morning.
Good morning, Larry.
So what's the speculation on the effect on what we pay for insurance?
Well, it's coming from a couple different directions. You know, one last year was incredibly expensive. I mean, we saw like $12 billion in insurance claims from last year's fires alone. We know the fires have continued this year unabated. And who ends up paying? Well, if you're a homeowner and you have insurance, it goes to your insurance company. But behind that, there are other people who can be made to pay, and what I've been looking at is utility companies, because a lot of the big fires we've seen end up being attributed to power lines, or a tree falls on a power line, some transformer explodes and causes a fire. Utility companies, under the way the law is set up now, end up carrying the liability for that. And so there's a big struggle going on right now at the legislature to shift the responsibility for utility-caused fires from utilities to others, meaning homeowners.
Yeah. And even if utilities end up, you know, paying significantly, how much of that ends up being passed on to us in higher utility costs? I understand it's a regulated supply of a utility, but still, at what point do we end up socked with the bill anyway? Also with us is California Insurance Commissioner Dave Jones. Commissioner, thank you for being with us again.
Great to be with you, Larry.
What are you anticipating in the way of potential homeowner insurance increases?
We anticipate two things are going to occur. One, we're going to see more insurers declining to renew or write new insurance for more homes in areas that are at high risk of fire. And two, we're going to see some increase in rates. Although the way that the rate regulation works in California, thanks to Proposition 103, which was enacted by the voters in 1988, there is a catastrophe factor in the rate, so insurers over time can recover for catastrophes, but they can't take the losses in one year and just cram them into next year's rates. Basically, we look back over 20 years' worth of catastrophes, we add the most recent losses, in this case $12.6 billion in insured losses that was referred to a moment ago in 2017, to the catastrophe factor. It gets basically averaged out over time, but it does have an impact on the rates going forward, and we anticipate that those homeowners that are living in high-risk areas will see some rate filings to increase their rates.
Well, if more insurers decline to insure areas that are newly considered hazardous, where will those people turn? Is California Fair Plan really the only place they can get insurance?
There are three places for people to go to get insurance. First is the traditional admitted market where most Californians go to get their homeowners insurance. Second is the surplus lines market. This is a less regulated market of insurers that offer more flexible coverages for people that can't find traditional insurance. And then third is the FAIR Plan. And it is a growing problem. We issued a report on this at my direction early this year. It's available on our website, insurance.ca.gov. If you go to the wildfire link, there's a whole host of information there for folks, but in particular, the report on the availability and affordability of coverage. Now, to put this in perspective, though, the FAIR Plan, which you referred to, that's the insurer of last resort that was established by the legislature some 40 years ago to write fire insurance, regardless of the risk, wherever you are in California. Those policy counts are going up. In 2014, in the wildland-urban interface area, there were about 22,000 such policies. Now, flash forward to December 2017, there's about 30,000 such policies, so about an 8,000 increase. But that's 30,000 policies in these high-brush, high-forested areas versus millions of homes that don't have to use the FAIR Plan and can find traditional insurance on the traditional market. So, yes, for those people that are facing this challenge, it's a big challenge. But put in broader perspective, it's not a crisis, although the trends are going in the wrong direction. There's no question.
Dave Jones, California Insurance Commissioner, KPCC Infrastructure Correspondent. Sharon McNary is with me. We'll continue our conversation and look at what the impact of year after year historic wildfires is having on the state homeowners insurance market here in California. Also, if you have a question, you can post it on the AirTalk page at kpcc.org. You can also tweet us at AirTalk. Talk back in just 1 minute. Good to have you with us on Air Talk. I'm Larry Mantle. We're looking at homeowners insurance and what the effect will be of historic wildfires in California. We're talking with the State Insurance Commissioner Dave Jones and KPCC Infrastructure Correspondent Sharon McNary. Dave Jones, on the California FAIR Plan, the insurer of last resort, given that I assume payouts under the FAIR Plan have increased with the increase in wildfire destruction, does that put more of a burden on California taxpayers? Will the legislature have to allocate more for the FAIR Plan? What ripple effect does this have?
The FAIR Plan is totally self-supporting. There's no taxpayer subsidy going to it. So the premiums for FAIR Plan policies are set based on the risk. There's no profit for the FAIR Plan, but there's no taxpayer subsidy either. But again, to put it in perspective, the FAIR Plan has about 30,000 or so policies in these wildland areas. They've suffered losses. So have the major insurers. But those companies are all adequately capitalized, as is the FAIR Plan, and they'll be able to make good on paying those claims.
And with the requirement that insurers moderate rate increases because of losses that they suffer, are you concerned that in doing that, I mean, the benefit that people don't get is shocked with their bills, that then more insurers are going to choose to opt out of insuring in riskier areas? I mean, isn't that a two-sided coin?
Well, insurers get the rate they need to cover the risk. So we look very carefully, and the insurers are very aggressive at providing very detailed information about their experience and losses. And if that justifies a rate increase, then they'll get a rate increase. And so we give insurers rate increases when they can justify, based on their losses, that their experience is such that it warrants an additional rate increase. And We have been doing that. We'll continue doing that. However, we also want to make sure that we don't jack up rates in 1 year based on just 1 year's experience. And so that's why we look back over some numbers of years. And for major catastrophes, we look back even further. Now, if we are in the new normal where we have these major catastrophes year after year, then that will be reflected in the rates. That catastrophic factor within the rates will climb significantly, as will the rates themselves.
Has your office been able to do a study to determine if this is the new normal, what percentage increase the typical homeowner would be looking at?
No, we look at rate filings as they're made. We scrutinize them very, very carefully and independently to make sure that the insurer has justified the rate. We're not in the prediction game with regard to where rates might go, other than what I've just shared with you generally, but rather we want to have in front of us the hard data to which we then apply the rate rules and decide whether the rate is sufficient or whether it needs to be higher or whether it's excessive.
Sharon?
Well, the discussion going on at the Capitol right now, coming from Governor Jerry Brown and in this joint conference committee on wildfire preparation and response, they're saying that the current system for allocating and managing risk for wildfires in California is unsustainable. The insurance industry doesn't live in a vacuum or a bubble. There's other aspects that also play into how much homeowners are paying. I'm interested in the commissioner's view on what should happen as far as wildfire risks and how much utilities should pay, how the insurance industry should pick up or not pick up some of that,
how that
flex.
How that burden is distributed.
Yeah.
Dave Jones?
Absolutely. I'm opposed to giving the utilities a free pass with regard to their liability for causing wildfires. You'll remember that CAL FIRE determined I think approximately 14 to 16 of the major fires in 2017 have been caused by PG&E. And so when they caused the fire, they should be liable for it. If the rules get changed, which is what's being considered by the legislature, that will leave many homeowners in the lurch who will be unable to recover fully for their loss. And it will have consequences for the insurance industry, too, which after it pays out losses, if a utility has been found to have caused the fire, then the insurance company can go to the utility for recovery, too. So I think it's a big mistake. I also think that there are many proactive things the utilities can and should be doing. And if you relieve them of the current liability rules, they'll have even less incentive to do those things already. For example, UC San Diego Scripps Institute has a technology that involves the use of infrared cameras that can sense the detection or can detect the ignition of fires. In Southern California, those cameras have been deployed in remote areas. They send a signal back to a server. When a fire is ignited, folks can be deployed right away. That technology has not been deployed in Northern California yet. It should have been. It should be. And so, yes, there's a lot of things we could do from a preventative standpoint,
right,
but letting the utilities out of the current liability rules, I think, is a mistake.
Could the utilities, though, listener asked this question, in risky conditions with high winds just decide, okay, we'll just shut down the power. It's too risky. We can't afford the financial exposure.
Well, that, in fact, is the protocol for some Southern California utilities. San Diego Gas and Electric and Sempra, in the wake of the big fires in San Diego in the first decade of the new century, decided to implement that very approach. PG&E, for whatever reason up north, last year was not implementing that approach. So, yes, absolutely. And PG&E has announced since the October 2017 fires that they will consider stopping power transmission in the event of a fire where there's high winds, and that the continued transmission of electricity might result in further fires. But these are the sorts of things that ought to be done, and the incentive to do them will diminish to the extent that the utilities are their liability standard has changed.
Sharon?
And in our area, Southern California, Edison also has a policy of de-energizing lines. And not only that, if a line goes down in a windstorm in one of these fire-prone areas, they won't automatically restart that line until it can go out and be visually checked to make sure it's not accidentally starting fires.
All right. Sharon McNary, KPCC infrastructure correspondent, David Jones, California Insurance Commissioner, thank you both for being with us. It's Air Talk on 89.3 KPCC. Well, with medical schools and law schools typically these days graduating more women than men, how is that affecting these two professions? In a recent edition of The Atlantic, Laura Bazelon, a professor at the University of San Francisco School of Law, wrote about the kinds of sexism that women in law often experience, from inappropriate comments, negative judgments made by attorneys, jurors, judges, even fellow women colleagues in law. I want to take this opportunity to open up the phones for you to weigh in if you're a woman who works in law or in medicine. And particularly if you've been in it for a number of years, what, if any, changes are you seeing in your professions as more women move into them? And what are some examples of sexism or double standards that you see that continue despite the fact there are more women working in these professions? 866-893-KPCC, 866-893-5722, or the Air Talk page, KPCC. CC.org. With me is Laura Bazelon of USF School of Law and author of the forthcoming book, Rectify. Professor, thank you for joining us.
Thank you so much for having me.
So share with us some of the things that women in law experience that their male colleagues don't have to endure.
One thing that they have to experience that stood out is the amount of preparation and thought that goes into their physical appearance before they go into the courtroom to try a case. So for men, generally speaking, if they're clean shaven or have a neatly trimmed beard and a nice suit and a white press shirt, that's sort of the end of it. For women, there's agonizing choices about clothes, about the height of your skirt, about heels, about conservative jewelry, conservative makeup, because your appearance is being scrutinized from every vector of the courtroom and the judgments about you can be quite condemning.
For litigators, how big a deal is this in facing a jury? Because you don't necessarily know what the attitudes of the women and men sitting on the jury are going to be about a woman's personal appearance.
That's right. Although I think the research has shown that jurors react somewhat negatively toward women that they perceive to be, quote, strident or loud or aggressive and dress in a manner that is not consistent with what they're used to thinking a woman trial lawyer should wear. So, for example, a dress or a skirt suit. And as I said, the sort of hair and makeup that's traditionally associated with a more feminine appearance and then mannerisms that are more traditionally associated with feminine mannerisms.
We're talking with Laura Bazelon, Professor, USF School of Law. I'd like to hear from you if you're a legal or medical professional, a woman who's worked in one of those fields, to share with us your thoughts about what you see as the gender differences in your field. Has that been mitigated at all by more women entering law and medicine? 866-893-KPCC. That's 866-893-5722. Back after a live update from Hedy Lynn Hurdies. It's Air Talk on 89.3 KPCC, prompted by a piece by law professor Laura Bazelon in The Atlantic. We're talking about the professions of law and medicine, those professions which have seen many more women enter in recent years as medical and law school graduates, in many cases women, now the majority. How has this affected the culture and expectations based on gender in those professions? And I'm asking women who either work in law or in medicine to share their thoughts on this. We're at 866-893-KPECC or the Air Talk page, kpecc.org. Wendy in Culver City, I understand you're an ER physician. What's your experience?
So overall, I can say it's been a good experience, but things that sort of tend to not change much are patients' expectations on women physicians. So even though, you know, the ER setting, we usually wear scrubs, but I purposely wear a white coat so patients can identify me as a doctor. My ID badge clearly says I'm a doctor, very big letters, and I introduce myself as a physician. I do a full physical exam. I do all this whole explanation. And after, you know, the patient has been seen, they continue to ask, when is the doctor going to see me?
Wow. And do you think this goes the opposite way, that men who are nurses are in many cases presumed to be doctors?
No, the x-ray tech, who is a male, walks by all the time and gets called the doctor. Very common.
So even all you know, these year, many years into so many women being in medicine, there's still, it sounds like almost like an instinct on the part. And do you find it's primarily with male patients or with women patients too?
No, I find it both. I think it's just the assumption, and you know, it's gotten better, but it's still very, very present in that way from the patients.
And do you, does it bother you at this point? Or are you inured to it because it's happened so often?
I think I used to be more bothered by it. I've been practicing for 7 years now, and so you get used to it. But, you know, it's always a little annoying to have to explain yourself more than your male colleagues.
Wendy, I really appreciate it. Thanks so much. Emergency room physician with her thoughts, 866-893-KPECC or the Air Talk page, kpecc.org. Michelle in Northridge, welcome.
Hi, Larry. I have been practicing law for 20 years now, and I have seen a tremendous and I think very positive change. When I first started practicing law, oftentimes I would be the only female attorney possibly in the courtroom. And now it is not at all uncommon to have female attorneys on both sides of a case, as well as a female bench officer, which is a tremendous change. And it's been a long time since I walked in somewhere with my case and been asked if I'm the court reporter, which used to happen quite a bit.
It used to happen. So how many years ago are we talking when that would not be uncommon to be asked that?
Oh, well, I've been practicing for years, and I probably haven't been asked that. It could also be because of my age, I don't know, but I haven't probably been asked that in about 10 years or so.
All right, so there's progress there. Are there still ways in which you perceive you are treated differently than a male colleague?
That's tough for me to answer. I currently work for myself. I have my own firm, and there are, at least in Los Angeles, a lot of female-only firms, both whether they're individual attorneys or multiple attorneys at a firm. There are still some older colleagues who will sometimes be a little bit condescending, but it's sometimes tough to tell if that's because they hold very traditional views and beliefs, or if it's because it's just their way of trying to, you know, get the upper hand in a case. I'm not really sure. But, you know, I let that stuff roll off my back. It's really exciting to me to see that so many women are practicing law and are making very high achievements here in Los Angeles County. I'm not one of them, but we have a lot of very high-powered, very well-known female attorneys, not just the ones that you see on TV all the time. So that's really exciting, and that's a good thing. When I remember the summer between being in college and law school, this older gentleman, I was waiting tables and talking with he and his wife about what I was doing, and his the husband said to me, well, that's terrible. You're never going to get married. No one's going to want to marry a woman that's an attorney. And, you know,
wow.
I hope that young women don't hear comments like that anymore. It didn't hold true for me. I'm happily married, and my husband is very, very supportive. And the other thing I'm noticing too, Larry, is that younger men in the legal profession tend to be very accepting of women, and they don't tend to hold those same traditional beliefs. So people coming up have been raising their kids right.
And they're going, Michelle, I assume, through law school, where the men may have been in the minority in law school.
I suppose that's possible. I wasn't aware of the article, so I'm really looking forward to reading the article that you've brought to me.
Michelle, thank you so much. Appreciate it. An attorney in Los Angeles sharing her perceptions in the courtroom and with her practice. Again, I'd like to hear from you. If you are a legal or medical professional, doctor or attorney or work in that field, even if you're not a doc or an attorney, you're a woman who's in this field, I'd like to hear your thoughts about how, as there's been more gender diversity in the fields, how the treatment of women has evolved, and in what ways do you think it's still kind of stuck, that it hasn't gotten to where it needs to be? 866-893-KPCC. That's 866-893-5722, or the AirTalk page, kpcc.org. Professor Bazelon, what about women on the bench? I assume because typically judges are older on average than attorneys because they practice for a while. Is there still a lag in getting more women on the bench?
There absolutely is. So across trial courts, state appellate courts, federal district courts, and federal courts of appeal, women are vastly outnumbered by men, usually by 2-1. So usually it's a third or less of judicial officers are women.
All right. And what's your sense of how that plays out with the predominance of male judges in the way that they interact with women attorneys?
So it's an interesting dynamic. I'll just give you an example. I found the first caller, the physician's experience, very resonant. When I started my job at USF in the fall of 2017, I went back in chambers with the judge who was presiding over the calendar. It was my first introduction to him, and my outgoing predecessor introduced me to the judge. There was a room full of lawyers, and we were there to appear on a case that was going to trial. He looked at me and said, "What year of law school are you in? Are you a second year or a third year?" And I explained that, no, I was the professor and I was taking over this position. And essentially his response was to tell me to take that as a compliment. Of course, at that point, I'd been practicing for 17 years, and he had essentially told a room full of lawyers that I didn't look like one, including the opposing counsel in our trial. So there are dynamics like that that still do happen. And I think some judges, of course, are very progressive and they make every effort to be fair. But it remains the case that most judges are older white men and they bring with them a lot of biases, both explicit and implicit.
Did you feel in that case then like you had to work harder to convince the judge of your professional competence, or did you see his comment as separate and apart from that?
I did see it as this extra hurdle that I had to jump through to convince him that I was, in fact, A, an attorney, and B, a competent and effective attorney. And I think my experience, unfortunately, is not unique, and that women receive that message a lot, and that for women of color, sometimes there's an even greater hurdle.
We're talking with University of San Francisco professor of law, Laura Bazelon, author of an Atlantic piece in which she detailed how, despite there being many more women in law, that often in the courtroom, they have to deal with a variety of things that men just don't. So I'm asking those of you that are legal and medical professionals, particularly, to join us at 866-893-KPCC, AirTalk page, kpcc.org, to share your experiences. Deirdre in North Hollywood, welcome.
Hi, so it's Deirdre. I'm actually an attorney in Los Angeles. I don't practice, but I work at one of the major law schools, and I just wanted to say that while the percentage of women in the classroom is definitely increasing, particularly at the school that I work at, there is still, disparate treatment of women in the classroom. So the way that women are being trained to think as lawyers and the way that they're being taught is definitely male-dominated still. And while there's not a ton of overt discrimination, there are just kind of small ways in which women are made to feel unwelcome oftentimes in the law classroom, whether it's because they're being taught mostly by men or because their opinions are pushed to the side oftentimes because of the fact that they're women. So that's something that's important to consider.
And, Deirdre, when you say pushed to the side, do you mean by other students that are in the class or by the professors or both?
I would say usually by other students. So I only have experience in the JD classroom, so like the 3-year, degree. But I oftentimes experienced pushback in the classroom and experienced my female classmates, the same thing happening to them. And again, this was about 5 years ago since I finished law school. But, there was definitely regardless of the topic being discussed, whether it was something controversial like abortion or something just very typical like contracts or property, female voices are often discounted in a way that male voices are not in a legal academic setting.
All right. And I want to hear the professor weigh in on that. Deidre, thank you so much. It's Air Talk on 89.3 KPCC. We'll hear a response from USF School of Law professor Laura Bazelon. We're at 866-893-KPCC. Back in 1 minute. Women in law and medicine, fields that have seen dramatic increases of the number of women going into both law and medical schools, many cases graduating more women than men in their classes. What effect is this having on gender dynamics in those fields? And in what ways are some of the old school gender expectations and practices continuing on despite changes in gender composition? We're at 866-893-KPECC. Or the Air Talk page, kpecc.org. Chance for you, if you're a woman who works in medicine or law, to share with us your experiences. And if you're a woman who's worked in medicine or law for a number of years, I'm interested in what you've seen over time as the shifts that have occurred. And how dramatic have those been? 866-893-KPECC. USF School of Law professor Laura Bazelon with us. Laura, I want to get your response to our last caller, Deidre, making the point that even in the classroom, as recently as 5 years ago when she was in law school, she felt that women's voices were just not taken as seriously, were pushed aside often in class. What do you think?
I think that that absolutely can be true. And I think she speaks to a bigger point about women's voices themselves, which is that the voices of women are policed in the same way that their bodies and their clothes are policed. So, for example, in the trial context, women who try and be aggressive and strong are often pushed back on as being screechy or shrill or strident. So I interviewed, I think, over 30 women for this piece, and many of them told me of situations in which they felt that their voices had been policed. And the example that comes to mind is a woman who's an extremely successful medical malpractice lawyer in Philadelphia. She was trying a case, and she was in the middle of her closing argument. She got very passionate because of the injuries that her client had suffered. The trial judge interrupted her three times to say, "Ms. Baldwin, they can hear you three courtrooms down," and essentially repeatedly telling her that her voice was too loud and too shrill. She ended up winning a $57 million verdict for her client, but what stood out to her was the way that the judge had interrupted her and essentially policed her voice throughout what was supposed to be the most powerful part of her case.
Let's take another call. Nora in San Marino, you're on Air Talk.
Hello. I was very fortunate to have graduated from Harvard Medical School in 2000, and then I subsequently practiced dermatology while going to law school at night. So I can compare and contrast the experiences. At Harvard Medical School, we were one of the first classes where the women had a greater, there were a greater number of women than men, and it was a very egalitarian community, an atmosphere in the classroom. But I felt that in law school, women voices were indeed not as respected, not quite as respected. I mean, when I would speak up in class, and I graduated as an auditorium of my law school class, I just felt that there was that the slight barrier, like a slight questioning of what I was saying in class.
Wow. Even though you're top student, you felt like there was this skepticism. And can you briefly explain sort of how that was expressed? Was it in attitude? Was it in words?
It was subtle because by that time there were also quite a few women in my class. I just felt that because the professors were mostly male, they did not take my contributions and those of my women classmates as seriously. We would be sometimes cut short in class, or, you know, our ideas were kind of just not given as much weight.
And are you practicing in law or medicine or both now?
I practice dermatology, but I'm also a tax attorney because I went on to obtain a Master of Law in Taxation at night.
Nora, I'm impressed. Quite an academic and professional credentials. Nora in San Marino with us on Air Talk, sharing her perspective. Alexandra in Pasadena, I understand you're a trial attorney in L.A.?
Hi, yeah. I'm a trial attorney in Los Angeles, so I do my work in front of 12 jurors. And I find that as a female trial attorney, if I want to win, I have to at times make sure that I'm likable, dial myself back so that I don't appear that I'm attacking the other side or that I'm too aggressive, and that I have to perform in a way that has to do with my gender and my likability in order to get the jury sometimes to go along with me.
Now, I would think that male attorneys would have to do some of that because it is a performance in front of a jury, and so that he would have to be thinking about some of these things. But you think just the degree of magnitude much more demanding for women to do that?
Oh, yeah. I've had jurors come up to me after trial and say, you know, you were really good, but your nails weren't done.
Wow.
Like that. Whereas I noticed that when I've watched my male colleagues do trials, that they aren't as concerned with likability, that they're aggressive seen as a more positive thing or as something that's expected. And being a trial attorney is aggressive by nature.
Sure. Well, and if you're introducing emotion because you're trying to connect on an emotional level with a jury, that's potentially a big impediment, right? If you're, as a woman attorney, you feel kind of you can't go as far that way as a man could because you're going to be questioned on that. That may limit your performance.
I wouldn't say it limits it, but you have to be super and hyper aware of it as you're doing a trial, that, you know, you are being judged by 12 people. Not so much your colleagues or the judge, but by 12 people who are looking at you through a very gendered lens.
Alexander, a great call. Thank you so much for joining us. My thanks as well to USF Law School professor Laura Bazelon, author of the forthcoming book Rectify, and author of the piece in the latest issue of The Atlantic about how, with many more women entering law, there still are double standards for how women and men attorneys are considered in the court. Have a wonderful afternoon. Fresh Air with Terry Gross is next. I'm back with you tomorrow morning at 10 for the next Air Talk on KPCC.